Tax update for Saturday, July 8th, 2006. Welcome to Tax Update for Saturday, July 8th, 2006. This week we look at a continuing controversy where the area that was muddy to begin with has gotten even more muddy in the recent past, and that's the area of advanced discounts received from suppliers and whether those are considered current taxable income or whether they are considered to be deferred revenue for tax purposes if you have to meet certain requirements in terms of volume in order to be allowed to keep the discount. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file of the podcast. Such prohibited use would include using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged without prior permission. The podcast is sponsored by Leinberg Information Services, located on the web at www.leinbergservices.com. Leinberg Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information on tax matters for tax practitioners who subscribe to their services. You can visit them on the web again at www.leinbergservices.com. This week, we look at an issue that we had previously looked at a number of weeks ago back last October when we discussed the Carnes Prime and Fancy Food case, Tax Court Memo 2005-233. Well, now the Ninth Circuit has weighed in on a different case, this one being Westpac Pacific Foods versus Commissioner, which was really decided by the tax court in 2001 as TC Memo 2001-175. The tax court, a couple of weeks ago, reversed the tax court a couple of weeks ago and has now held that in this case, the amounts received were not income. We're going to take a look at the IRS position on such payments, the tax court's apparent position on such payments, and the position the Ninth Circuit brought forward. The issue we're going to face is that each one is very different, and they go from, shall we say, least taxpayer-friendly at the IRS side down to the most taxpayer-friendly at the Ninth Circuit side, with the tax court having a sort of nuanced position in the middle that can be interesting to apply. But we're going to take a look at all three positions and try to make some sense out of this and try to give you something you can go forward with your clients to advise them on maybe what they should or shouldn't be doing if they are receiving advance payments that are conditioned upon their meeting certain targets in terms of acquiring certain amounts of goods from their supplier. And we're going to look at a number of odd cases for what goes on here. The key issue involves a set of Supreme Court cases from a number of years ago and where these payment schemes fall into the feeling for the Supreme Court cases as to whether these amounts are really more accurately depicted as loans to the taxpayer or whether they should be considered prepaid income for which there is a conditional obligation to perhaps have to repay the amount in question. Well, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, as noted, reversed the tax court in its holding in Westpac Pacific Foods. Now, that case, by the way, since it's back from 2001, 5 years ago, you'll notice has been referenced in other cases, including the Carnes case. The tax court referenced their holding in Westpac. Well, now we have a reversal in the Ninth Circuit. That's of interest because it suggests for taxpayers in the Ninth Circuit, we may be facing a much more liberal standard of what can be excluded from income, as well as an issue that in other circuits, we're not sure where we're going to stand when these cases that have currently been decided by the tax court move up the line and face appeal. Now, Westpac, the fact of the case was we have a partnership that was formed among three grocery chains, Raley's, Save Mart, and Bel Air. And the purpose of this partnership was to purchase and warehouse inventory of goods. And the partnership entered into four supply agreements that we're going to be interested in today because these are the four supply agreements that come into question in the case and that we look at the payments received at the start of these agreements as to whether Westpac is required to recognize them as income currently for income tax purposes or whether they must or whether they are allowed to instead recognize this income essentially as they purchase product, move that into inventory, and then only run it through income essentially when they sell the goods eventually that are basically associated with these discount arrangements. Now, they had agreements with GTE Sylvania for light bulbs, Ambassador for the purchase of Hallmark greeting cards, American Greetings for bows, wrapping papers, etc., and McCormick for spices. In some cases, the agreements provided for an exclusivity arrangement where this would be the exclusive supplier to the supermarkets in question. All of them, though, provided for the fact that there would be certain minimum amounts of goods that Westpac would have to purchase under those agreements. If Westpac failed to meet the minimum obligations for the purchase of goods from each supplier, Westpac had to repay a pro rata portion of the prepayment. Now, that would be true if Westpac canceled the agreement before the end of the term to be used for measuring this, or if they just failed to meet that obligation at the end of the term. In reality, in two cases, GTE Sylvania contract and the American Greetings contract, Westpac was failing to meet the goals, terminated the agreement, and did pay back a pro rata share of the amount they had received. So these were the facts on the table when we start looking at this case. Now, the IRS original position, which the tax court accepted in their original decision on the Westpac case, was that these amounts are income. And the tax court used Code Section 61 and noted that it broadly defined gross income as all income from whatever source defined. It referenced the case of Commissioner versus Glenslaw Glass Company, which was a U.S. Supreme Court decision, 348 U.S. 426, decided in 1955. And because the court concluded that in Glenslaw Glass, which was regarding two payments for punitive damages, but it said it described them as undeniable accessions to wealth clearly realized and over which the taxpayer have complete dominion. The concept of complete dominion is going to become crucial as we go through these cases, because when we get down to the end of it, what we're really deciding here in differentiating all these positions is what is meant by complete dominion over the assets or over the income in question. Now, the tax court goes on to note that Section 451 sets forth the general rule that gross income, that item be included in gross income, a tax return which is received by the taxpayer, unless under the method of accounting used by the taxpayer in computing income, that amount is properly accounted for in a different period. Westpac, as the tax court notes, was an accrual method taxpayer. The tax court also agrees that for generally accepted accounting principles purposes under GAAP, that Westpac was required to basically not recognize this entire amount in income immediately, but rather they had to treat it as deferred income and only pull it into income ratably as they met the terms of the agreement, as they acquired the inventory, so it would flow into inventory and then flow out to their cost of goods. And the tax court fully agrees that is the treatment for GAAP purposes. But the tax court noted there are different rules for GAAP and for tax purposes that you can't apply one to the other. Therefore, and in fact, the Ninth Circuit even agrees with that statement that there are different concepts and different issues that we have in place. Now, but the tax court comes to the conclusion that pursuant to the principles in general, and they look at Section 1.451-1A of the regs, the right to receive income becomes fixed at the earliest of required performance, the date the payment becomes due, or the date the payment is made. Well, under their test, when they apply that regulation to Westpac, they determined that, in fact, the payment was made today at the start of the agreement, since that's the earliest of the three dates. If Section 451 controls this item, then, therefore, it became fixed at that point. We generally record it in income. The question, though, that will come into play is, did they really have complete dominion? Because as the Ninth Circuit points out, and so does the tax court in numerous cases, if you borrow funds, you may have complete dominion over them, but they're not considered an item of income. And that's going to be the question we're going to go over here. Now, the tax court, as in Carnes, rejected specifically the application of the Indianapolis Power and Light case, specifically arguing that the amounts were not similar to customer deposits in that case. In that case, they saw that the key question came down to the fact that in Indianapolis Power and Light, and it was Indianapolis, not Indiana, Indianapolis Power and Light, they felt that that case was definitely different than what we saw here. And in fact, in Carnes, they made clear the question became, was the taxpayer the person in control of being able to assure whether or not repayment had to be made? They differentiate that in Indianapolis Power and Light, the customers actually controlled whether those deposits had to be repaid. If the customers performed according to their contract, the amounts would be repaid. Now, Westpac, having been basically losing at the tax court, appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Ninth Circuit panel hearing the case issued its decision recently, and the Ninth Circuit viewed the matter differently. In fact, the introductory paragraphs are kind of funny and interesting when Judge Kleinfeld writes that, quote, "It's hard to think of a way to make money by buying things. A child may think buying things is how one makes money. He sees his father give a clerk a single piece of paper money and receive in exchange the goods purchased, several pieces of paper and a number of coins. And a person may jokingly say to a spouse, I made $100 today after buying something on sale for $100 off. But everyone knows these are merely amusing remarks and not really the way to make money." Then the court outlines a hypothetical where Harry homeowner goes to a furniture store, spouts dining room chairs for $500 each and said he'll take four if you give me a discount. He negotiates a 25% discount and he would pay only $1,500. Except now they say, suppose that he's short on cash, he negotiates a deal where he gives him 20% discount in cash advance instead of the 25% off. So the store gives him $400 cash back today and he pays $2,000 for the chair when they are delivered shortly after the first of the year. The court notes in that fact pattern, Harry can't go home and say, I made $400 today unless he plans to skip out on the obligation to pay for those chairs that he ordered. He has to sell the chairs for more than $1,600 if he really wants to make money on this transaction. And the court notes specifically, quote, the reason why the $400 cash back is not income is that like a loan, the money is encumbered with a repayment obligation to the furniture store and the cash back must be repaid if Harry does not perform his obligation. The court then notes that this particular case is basically, in its view, the same set of facts, even though the math is a little bit more complicated, even though the numbers are bigger, we're still looking at the same basic issue that we have to deal with. Now, in a footnote, it notes the government had argued that the government argues there's no evidence Westpac was actually purchasing these goods at full price. The court indicated they found no evidence to the contrary, and in fact, that since Westpac repaid the pro rata agreements, they just kind of basically treat them as discounts on volume, that nowhere else aside from the blanket assertion of the government is there any reason to believe that these prices were not the actual normal prices that Westpac would have paid. Now, the introductory paragraph pretty much telegraphs what the outcome of the case is going to be, what the decision is going to come down to. But it's really interesting to look at the details of how we got there, because in many ways, the facts of this case don't look terribly different than the facts we saw in Carnes Prime and Fancy Foods. Reviewing that case, you may remember that a supplier received money that was going to be used to basically allow them to expand from their suppliers, and they would have to repay that obligation, but their repayments would be credited back to them if they met certain requirements, or basically as long as they met certain agreements, they wouldn't have to repay the loan as long as they met certain volume requirements on the basis over the term, and if they performed under the contract, their full obligation would be paid off. Now, looking at that, this appears very similar. As long as Westpac buys the proper amount of goods and basically meets the terms of the contract, it will not have to send these discounts back to the various suppliers, GTE Sylvania, American Greetings, etc. We don't have to give them money back. Now, the Ninth Circuit starts from the basic outline of relevant provisions of law to kind of start their analysis. And again, they note the definition of gross income is expansive, same agreement as the tax court had. They also note Commissioner versus Glenshaw Glass, while the punitive damages received by a successful litigant were income because they were accession to wealth, clearly realized, and over which the taxpayers have complete dominion. The court note the government argues that we fit that definition because Westpac had complete dominion over the money. In the government's view, the issue was they did not have to put the cash to a trust account and they could spend the money as it chose. But the court note that leaves out one very important item for income. That is, it must be an accession to wealth. As the court notes, quote, one may have complete dominion over money, but it does not become income until it is an accession to wealth. That is why borrowed money is not income, even though the borrower has complete dominion over the cash. Because of this repayment obligation, the loan proceeds do not qualify as income to the taxpayer. To the Ninth Circuit, there were three key U.S. Supreme Court decisions we had to look at to try to figure out where this case fell in. Those cases were, on the one hand, Indianapolis Power and Light, a case we've already discussed briefly, and on the other hand, Automobile Club of Michigan and Schulte. Those are two cases, one from 1957, one from 1963. Indianapolis Power and Light's a 1990 case. So all of these cases have been around for a while. We've been working under the newest one for 16 years. In Indianapolis Power and Light, the Supreme Court held that security deposits received by a utility from its customers were not income, but rather more like loans. The court noted that the deposits were required to be paid back when service ended. So even though Indiana Power and Light had full dominion and control of the funds, they didn't have to put them in a trust account, they could put them in their regular account, they didn't have to segregate them or treat them specially. When they received them, the transaction was more like a loan than an item of income. So long as the customers performed under the contract as specified, they made all their utility payments at the end of the utility, at the end of the time they had service from the utility, they would receive back their deposit. On the other side of the issue were two cases that dated back a number more years, Automobile Club of Michigan from 1957 and Schulte from 1963. In Automobile Club of Michigan, we had an automobile club, makes sense, that provided services to its customers, like providing its members, I should say, such as providing maps, doing road repairs, flexing flat tires, all the things we all know that auto clubs do. And they received payment from their members a year in advance. As we all know, if you're a member of an auto club, that's also very normal. The question becomes, we receive payment today, let's say, for a year that's going to begin at the 1st of August. Do we include that all in income today now that we've got the cash, or do we spread that over the year from August into the next year? If we're a calendar year taxpayer, that's going to tell us whether we pick up income. Basically, we get to keep 7/12 of that out of income at the end of December, because that's the 7 months of the year 2007 that we still have to perform services in order to earn that amount. No question that for generally accepted accounting principles, we defer that number. We don't get to recognize 100% of income because we have an obligation all the way through the 12 months. However, the Supreme Court held this was income. The court emphasized that although the organization was obligated to provide services over that next year period, the pro rata application of the deferred income to services bore no relationship to the services actually performed. Everybody doesn't call the auto club every month for a flat tire. Everybody doesn't call the auto club every month to get maps. You know, basically, the way that income disappears has no real relationship to the services earned. So in the court's view, and there's no refund provision generally allowed, so long as the auto club doesn't violate its contract or go out of business, it's not going to owe the money back to the members. As long as it provides the option for you to receive those services, the fact that you didn't actually ever get a flat tire fixed, never actually asked for a map during the year, does not mean that the auto club is going to now have to repay you even though they did nothing for you during that year. So the Supreme Court held under that fact situation, the Automobile Club of Michigan had to pick up that amount as income in the year it was received. A second case was a case of Schulte, which dealt with payments for ballroom dancing lessons. And in Schulte, they said essentially that you again had to pick up the amounts as income when received. In the contract signed by the customers of Schulte, you gave them a payment in advance for a certain number of lessons you were to receive on schedule. Schulte did not have to refund those payments even if you missed your appointment. So even if you didn't show up for a lesson, Schulte got to keep the money. Schulte did not have to refund those amounts. Again, except in the contingency that they weren't available to offer them at all, there wasn't going to be an issue where Schulte would have to kick the money back to the customers. In this case, the Supreme Court went further down the line, and unlike what we had in the auto club where they said, well, there's no obvious relationship between income and services, in Schulte there does appear to be such a relationship. I can figure out there are 5 lessons. I'm going to perform those lessons, so I could pick up 1/5 each time. The Supreme Court still held in this case that essentially because we were dealing with a case of prepayment and essentially there was no obligation to repay that was sitting there that had any level of certainty of being involved. And in fact, basically, Schulte really had full control over making this happen. Schulte had to pick up these amounts in income. Now, the Ninth Circuit had to decide whether Westpac was more close to the facts in Indianapolis Power of Light with the deposits or the Automobile Club of Michigan and Schulte. Now, the Ninth Circuit interprets these facts. I will point out that the tax court probably wouldn't disagree with the choice of cases. Where they're going to disagree is going to be on what exactly the Supreme Court meant in Indianapolis Power and Light and what exactly the Supreme Court meant in Automobile Club of Michigan and Schulte. But the Ninth Circuit said to it, this looked more like Indianapolis Power and Light. And they think it's much closer to that set of facts than it is the Automobile Club. How did they arrive at this conclusion? Well, let's look at the facts of the GTE Sylvania contract. That's one of the four contracts they had. In July of 1990, they made a deal with Sylvania GTE to basically become the exclusive light bulb supplier for Westpac and its member stores for 4 years, that they would, quote, aggressively and regularly advertise and promote GTE Sylvania's products, they'd dedicate a certain amount of lineal shelf space to GTE Sylvania's products in all of its member stores, and finally, they would purchase at least $17 million in light bulbs during the term. In exchange for that, GTE agreed to pay Westpac $1.1 million as an unearned advanced allowance. GTE paid this to Westpac by check and agreed to pay Westpac another $200,000 on the first, second, third anniversary of the agreements, provided that GTE was satisfied with the warehouse distribution agreement. The contract referred to this $1.7 million in payment as Westpac allowance and specifically provided upon termination of this agreement that Westpac would reimburse GTE Sylvania on a prorated basis for any portion of the allowance advanced but not earned due to failure to purchase at least $17 million in lamps. During 1991 tax year, GT Sylvania paid that first $200,000 payment to Westpac. Problem became that Westpac could not sell enough light bulbs to meet its minimum volume the contract called for, so it terminated that arrangement in 1994. The termination letter acknowledged the obligation to pay back the pro rata share, and in fact it did pay back over $860,000 to GTE Sylvania in December of 1994. The court goes through a similar analysis on the other three contracts in question, and in another one of those contracts, Westpac actually repaid the supplier because they didn't meet the obligation. The Ninth Circuit then goes on and gives a conclusion, and it says to it that this case is like Indianapolis Power. The cash trade discounts are like security deposits in that they are subject to repayments, and unlike membership dues, the recipients cannot keep the money regardless of what happens after receipt. Westpac could only retain the full upfront trade discount if it met volume requirements. Like the security deposit, the cash advance is subject to repayment. The only difference is that repayment in this case may not be the full amount advanced by the vendor, but that is because the repayment amount is reduced pro rata to the extent Westpac fails to fulfill its agreement. The court goes on to note, because the taxpayer here has to pay the money back, the volume requirements are not met, it is not an accession to wealth as required by Glensaw Gas. Westpac either has to buy a specified volume of goods for more than it would otherwise pay or pay back the money, just like Harry Homeowner. Thus, the cash advance discounts are like a loan or customer security deposits, liability rather than income when received. The Ninth Circuit then goes on and notes it's going to apply another case, a decision in a prior case that it thinks also applies in this case, and that was a case that involved the NFL's Oakland Raiders, Millenbach versus Commissioner, from a 2003 decision. In that case, the court held that the Raiders did not have to recognize as income a $6.7 million non-recourse note as income when received, even though the terms of the note provided the note would only be paid out of revenue from luxury boxes to be built in the future. In reality, the Raiders never built those boxes, and therefore no liability was ever actually paid. The court held that at the date the liability came out, the obligation was real, even if in fact it never ended up actually being paid. Now we have relief of debt obligation coming down the line. That's a whole different problem. But on the instant of payment, it's not income. The court pointed out that Westpac not only had an actual obligation in their case, but they really did repay money. So if anything, Westpac was, I guess, in the view of the court, more deserving than the Oakland Raiders were in terms of being able to exclude this money. Now, here comes the key question. We have this decision. How do we reconcile this or even attempt to reconcile it to what the tax court held in Carnes and other cases we've seen come down the line? Now, in the Carnes case, the tax court also considered Indianapolis Power and Light, but they view its consequences very differently than the Ninth Circuit did. To the tax court, the key lesson from Indianapolis Power and Light involved whether it was the taxpayer or a third party who was in control of the amount that would be repaid. As the court noted in its opinion of the Carnes case, we essentially, you know, the plaintiff, Carnes, had argued Indianapolis Power and Light applies because we might have to repay this money. It says that their reliance on Indianapolis Power and Light missed the point the Supreme Court established in that case. Parenthetically, I would add, I would suspect the judge believes the Ninth Circuit missed the point on this one too, as we'll describe. The issue presented in Indianapolis Power and Light was whether certain deposits that the taxpayer or power company received from its customers were income. In resolving that issue, the Supreme Court analyzed whether the taxpayer enjoined complete dominion or control over such deposits. The Supreme Court held the taxpayer did not have complete dominion over deposits in question because it did not have some guarantee it would be allowed to keep them. According to the Supreme Court, by making timely payments of the respective utility bills, the customers and not the taxpayer, by the way, that seems to be the key issue as far as the tax court is concerned, controlled whether the taxpayer be able to return the deposits that it received from such customers. Now we'll consider the Carnes case, where you remember it was, again, like in Westpac, an issue of would Carnes purchase enough volume. In contrast to the situation presented in Indianapolis Power and Light, Super Right did not have control over the events that petitioner asserts would have constituted a material breach of it of the April 16, 1999 supply agreement. Now, Super Right was the supplier who paid Carnes the advance, or who gave them the loan. And because, in essence, Carnes was in control, on the record before us, they found the petitioner had some guarantee that for each annual accounting period covered by the April 16, 1999 supply agreement and the corresponding April 15, 1999 note, it would be allowed to keep the amount of the annual payment set forth in the note so long as for each period it lived up to its end of the bargain by not materially breaching the April 16, 1999 supply agreement. If you applied that analysis to Westpac, then it would appear clearer that Westpac would include the amount in income. It would be in a similar position to Carnes. Similarly, and reversing that, it would appear that if you applied the Ninth Circuit's ruling to Carnes, or the Ninth Circuit's analysis of what Indianapolis Power and Light means to Carnes, Carnes would not pick this amount up in income. So we clearly have a different view of what counts. Now, the bad news for Mr. Carnes is that, unfortunately, his appeal doesn't go to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Not so good, so therefore, we'll have to see if another circuit's going to agree if Carnes decides to appeal his case. Now, the IRS, in fact, has an even more hard-line approach. The IRS doesn't like the position the tax court advances. In fact, this week, the IRS announced that they would not follow the tax court holding in Erickson Post-Acquisition versus Commissioner, announcing non-acquiescence with that decision. That was a case where cash payments were received from a wholesaler to a retailer, were stated as a loan, but which were expected to be repaid at least in part via future discounts that the taxpayer would not receive but would be applied against notes. In that case, the tax court did not require the taxpayer to pick up the extra amount of income. And in fact, that case, they actually went and specifically differentiated that case, which was decided after the tax court decided Westpac. They differentiated the results in that case from Westpac, and they said, at that point, quote, from the Erickson Post case, the focus is on the obligation created at the time of the transaction. In Westpac Foods versus Commissioner and Colombo versus Commissioner, when payments were made, the recipients of the funds had no obligation to repay the funds. That obligation would arise later if and when the recipient breached his underlying obligation to purchase the product. Here, when Amoco paid the $175,000 to Petitioner, Petitioner had an unconditional obligation to repay the full amount of the note. Now, it's important to note that in Erickson Post, the agreements, even presuming the taxpayer was in full control of keeping the agreement with Amoco for supply in place, would not have paid off the entire advance. The note provided it would be repaid over 10 years. The supply agreement only ran for 5, so only half of the note really could have been paid off simply by executing a supply agreement. If Amoco didn't renew at the end of 5 years, Erickson Post still had to advance the rest of the funds back and had no guarantee of repayment. The facts in the case in question, though, caused the tax court to view the transaction as a loan rather than income. So Erickson Post could not fully pay off its note by merely executing the agreement, and in fact, it wasn't clear from the facts whether they really could control any of the repayment totally, or whether Amoco could not have terminated the agreement and simply required full repayment. However, it's important to note the IRS does not agree with the tax court's Erickson Post position, and clearly wouldn't agree with the Ninth Circuit. Therefore, we should say it is safe to presume that in almost any advance payment arrangement, the IRS position is going to be the amount is income in the year it is received, period, regardless of any obligation that may exist to repay that amount. If there is a method via purchasing discounts to receive that amount, to basically, you know, earn that amount out, the tax court or the IRS is going to hold that you have to recognize that as income. The tax court seems to primarily look at whether you have control over fully getting rid of that obligation by simply performing under the contract. If the only way you're going to pay is if you default, the tax court position is, well, that's income today. If you don't have such full control, then the tax court position is it's not income. And the Erickson Post case seems to be in a fuzzy area in the middle, but the tax court came down, said not income. The IRS does not agree. An interesting aside is to be found in a TAM that Dr. Bill Raby pointed out to me as we were discussing this case in preparation for doing a recording of a video session for a BISC. And that is in TAM 2006-05-010. Where the IRS did allow a taxpayer to offset rebates against cost of sales, run that through inventory essentially, and then come through cost of sales as goods were sold. Now, the actual TAM dealt primarily with the issue of whether these rebates were being received for advertising services performed by the taxpayer on behalf of the suppliers, in which case would be current income, or whether they truly were purchasing discounts. And in the TAM, the national office held that they truly were purchasing discounts. Now, but the TAM goes to point out essentially that one of the little issues is there is a footnote pointing out so long as the payments are not made in advance, we feel that's fine. And they specifically note the Westpac decision. We presume, the TAM said, that these payments are not Westpac-style payments from the 2001 tax court memo. So what the IRS position would be, as long as you don't receive advance payments, if you earn your discount, receive the payment at the end of the term, you then can capitalize that and spread that out over future goods to be received, or at least spread out over goods received in the future. It's a purchase discount. However, if you receive the entire payment up front, then you must include that all in income in the year of receipts. Note that even the agents examining the taxpayer in the TAM request were not asserting this was not the case, that the discounts paid and earned were did not go through cost of goods sold, didn't go through the inventory. Rather, the whole issue there was whether, in fact, this taxpayer was performing advertising services, and that's the holding of that TAM. So it presents an interesting issue to understand that if your discounts are being paid based on current earnings and are not prepayments of the discount that the taxpayer could lose, then it appears we do get to run them through inventory. Well, where do we stand? Right now, probably more confused than ever. Certainly, it didn't improve the view of the situation after Carnes so that we understood where we're going. We weren't terribly clear at the end of Carnes with Erickson Post as to where exactly we stood and what was the bright line between Erickson Post and Carnes. Now we have basically three positions to deal with. The IRS and the Ninth Circuit have diametrically opposed views of the law on this one. To the IRS, any advance payment scheme is going to be income in the year of receipt, even if you might have to pay the whole thing back if you didn't earn out. To the Ninth Circuit, this sort of advance payment scheme where you have to earn it out is not income in the year of receipt, but rather only goes into income and essentially goes in indirectly because it would be released to the purchases as they're made. They would go to inventory, and then as the inventory is sold, we'd finally see the discounts hit income. So the Ninth Circuit and the IRS have diametrically opposed views. The tax court, in the interim, has a subtle position in the middle that seems to concentrate most heavily on who controls whether, in fact, we're going to be able to meet the terms of the contract. If we're going to have to if the repayment is controlled by the supplier of the funds so that they could unilaterally cause us to have to pay it back, then that's not income. But if we're in full control, and as long as we execute the full terms of the contract, the debt will never be repaid, then from the tax court's view, the rule of Indianapolis Power and Light says you don't pick that up. The key question to be decided is whose view of Indianapolis Power and Light is right, the tax court or the Ninth Circuit? Or, in fact, is the IRS correct and Indianapolis Power and Light doesn't apply to this case at all for any reason? So what do we tell a client who's looking to get, who's going to get a cash advance from a supplier, perhaps for expansion purposes? They're often used as an incentive to get you to go in, or an incentive to get you to do work for the supplier. Well, I think you have to take a look at a couple of issues. First, if you're in the jurisdiction of the Ninth Circuit, then you probably have a better chance of making this fly, because there the IRS agent is going to have to respect, and the tax court would have to respect, the holding of the Ninth Circuit as a matter of law, that these payments will not be income until or unless, basically, we've earned our way out. As long as the repayment obligation is there, we have something to go with. That said, I still would expect the IRS to challenge such items on exam and perhaps force you up the line at least to appeals before you're going to get an out. That's especially true since the national office has indicated in Erickson Post that they really don't agree with the position that was stated even in Erickson Post. And so clearly, if you don't agree Erickson Post was decided correctly, there's no way you're going to agree that Westpac was decided correctly by the Ninth Circuit. Outside the Ninth Circuit, I think taxpayers have to be concerned that they need to be dealing with the tax court test initially. That is, their real push, if you get examined, is the IRS is definitely going to disallow. Their position is they don't follow Erickson Post. So if you have a taxpayer outside the Ninth Circuit, then you're going to have to deal with the concept that almost certainly, unless we litigate, we're not going to get a break from the IRS. The IRS is in a position of wanting to challenge Erickson Post. Therefore, taxpayers in those locations are going to have to be warned that their risk profile is much higher if they don't pick this all up as income, and that on exam, I would say it is a 100% certainty, as long as the agent is competent, that you are going to have a disallowance or the inclusion of all of that in income in the year of receipt. Finally, remember, in any case like this, it is always the taxpayer's decision, not the accountant, not the CPA, not the attorney, not the EA, not any of those people involved. It is finally the taxpayer's decision as to what they feel about the risks involved and the benefits involved. Our job is to present to the taxpayer the risks and benefits that exist from the various positions. And so long as that position is supportable under the law, we can accept any position the taxpayer wants to take that can be supported. Our job is to make sure they are fully apprised of the risks and issues they are facing. This has been the Tax Update, dealing with this wonderful little confusion issue we now have over discounts. Tax Update, as always, is presented by Lineberg Information Services on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. You can visit them there and subscribe to their services, which provide email newsletters that'll be of interest to tax professionals, plus access to additional information of interest to tax professionals. Again, visit them on the web, www.lineburgservices.com. This has been Tax Update.